Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, we've all heard the weather-related doomsday scenarios. If global warming goes unchecked, rising sea levels, submerging cities, more frequent and violent storms, a looming ice age. But the effects of climate change aren't just in some different environmental future. Its effects are already being felt, and it might surprise you how. Stefan Ferris, author of the new book, Forecast, The Consequences of Climate Change from the Amazon to the Arctic, from Darfur to Napa Valley, explains how the modest increase in global temperatures has already sparked violence, changed economies, and has made political conflicts harder to solve. Stefan Ferris is also going to be covering climate change for the news outlet GlobalPost.com, and he joins me now. Stefan, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. I'm a big fan. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. We tend to think of global warming as primarily an environmental concern, but you argue that we need to think of it in terms of war and peace, even, and the global economy. Where do you start?
Sure. I guess what's happening is global climate change is already having an effect all over the world, and in places that, let's say, are least able to adapt, it's already having a very severe effect. In the book, I try to explore and explain how our emissions through the warming of the southern oceans have disrupted the African monsoons and perhaps led to conflict in Darfur.
Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, I see, cited you when he said that the Darfur conflict began as an ecological crisis arising in part from climate change. It is no accident, he said, that the violence in Darfur erupted during the drought. So can you explain some of the science of that, how rising ocean temperatures changed Darfur physically and how that led to political change?
Sure. Probably the easiest way is to go backwards. The conflict in Darfur is a political conflict, and in a sense, it's the government's response to a civil war. But the schisms of on which side the two sides fall on are largely more lifestyle based. On one side, you have what we call African farmers, and on the other side, we have what we call Arab herdsmen. And those two sides, more or less, were living in peace for decades, if not centuries. What happened is in the 70s and 80s, there was a very long drought, and that drought started to degrade the land, and the land was basically no longer fertile enough to support both lifestyles. And so conflict started to develop between these two sides. Now, when the government came and saw that it was a rebellion, they used that conflict to kind of accelerate the situation and put down the rebellion, and in a sense led to the atrocities we've seen in Darfur. Now, the question is, what relationships, how did that drought happen? For quite a while, scientists thought that drought was caused by the locals, that they were cutting down trees, and that was through a physical process reducing the rainfall in the region. But there's been a few scientists who have looked at these climate change models, these computer models of how the world works, how the atmosphere works, how it interacts with land use and everything else, and they've shown that the drought very well may have been caused by the warming of the tropical and southern oceans. This is the same type of warming that could be leading to stronger hurricanes off the Gulf Coast.
And it's not just in the developing world. You're right that the unusually mild winter in Europe last year, or really in 2007, caused an early breeding season for mosquitoes in Italy. It's what you call the first European outbreak of a climate-driven epidemic. What did those mosquitoes cause?
They caused a tropical disease called chikungunya, which is a relative of dengue, which causes kind of high fevers, aches, and bones, and is quite an uncomfortable situation.
People in the United States don't know that disease. Dengue fever, right?
It's a relation to dengue fever. It's similar to dengue fever, right?
Yeah, which is, you know, very very common and deadly in tropical areas. So go ahead. What happened in Italy?
Well, in Italy, you had essentially an Italian tourist who went to India, and he got this disease, and he brought it back. And in an ordinary year, that wouldn't have done anything. The disease would have affected him, and eventually he would have died. But that year, he had a mild winter, and these Asian tiger mosquitoes that have been introduced to Italy in the last few decades had bred in large numbers. And so all of a sudden, you had enough of these little tiny mosquitoes zipping around. They were able to infect, and it hit an outbreak that was fairly localized. It was basically one town in northern Italy, but out of about 2,000 people in that town, about 100 came down with this tropical disease. And it's officials of the World Health Organization who have said that this may be the first climate change triggered outbreak of a tropical disease in Europe. It is important to notice that it's very difficult to tell what's climate change and what's not. More mild winters are what we expect from climate change. This mild winter may or may not have occurred otherwise.
Right, and we're in the grip of a very cold winter in a lot of places right now. I heard somebody railing against the global warming theory or the global warming science on another radio station yesterday, saying, "Hey, look, it's colder in Siberia now than it's been in 25 years. Colder in Alaska than it's been in 25 years, et cetera, et cetera." So, you know, they just dismissed it as, "Oh, this global warming, it's a lot of political bunk." But
sure.
I guess
one data point doesn't really make a trend, though.
Right.
We're still in the early stages of climate change, and so the signal of climate change is still being swamped by the noise of natural variability. So if you think of the climate or the weather changing year by year or decade by decade, we're still in a situation where the effects of climate change are not yet totally swamping out the noise.
And one of the really sad and unfair aspects of this, as you point out in the book, is that the poorest parts of the world disproportionately suffer from climate change, while richer countries like the U.S. are largely responsible for it, but are more insulated. Why are we more insulated?
Well, we're more insulated for two reasons. One, by pure accident of geography. We're in northern latitudes where warming will be easier to absorb. In some ways, some people have projected that in the short term at least, agriculture production will almost be favored by the warming of the world. But the more basic reason why we're able to respond is that we're richer, and we're able to adapt more, and we're able to pay for things that we have more of a buffer. So if there's food shortages, well, we can still afford to buy the food. If there's hurricanes off the coast, what global warming does indeed lead to stronger storms, well, we're able to mobilize a response. If diseases spread further, we're able to fund health clinics and mosquito control and things that will limit. I mean, one of the more dramatic examples are, say, Bangladesh and the Netherlands. Both are very low-lying areas. They both have large portions of their territory that are either at or below sea level. But the difference is the Dutch can afford to build a rather elaborate flood control system. And the Bangladeshis, for the most part, they do some flood control, but for the most part, if the seas are going to rise, and they're projected to rise somewhat at least by the end of the century, there's not much they can do. They can try to head for higher land, they can try to head for different countries, but they just don't have the funding and the infrastructure to be able to respond to it.
And there's kind of a weird irony that you point out, which is that rising sea levels obviously threaten coastal cities, but instead of making these areas less desirable, coastal areas like, say, Cape Cod beaches are becoming scarcer and therefore more expensive.
Right? Yeah, that's probably true. They're becoming more expensive for a second reason as well. One industry that's really paid attention to global warming and seems to at least, in terms of putting their money where their mouth is, be convinced is the insurance industry. So a lot of these places are actually becoming a lot harder to find insurance. If you're living there, insurance rates are going up.
Right.
In some places, insurance companies have pulled out altogether.
Which means that prime land is therefore becoming even more of a commodity reserved only for the rich around the coasts.
That's right. One of the places I visited was Key West, which is kind of the southernmost tip of the United States. It's like on the last island on the stretch of Keys off the tip of Florida, and it's a place that traditionally has been more or less a trading town. It was attempts to make it into a major port. Now it's making its living off of tourism, and it's basically mostly been for most of its time been a fairly middle class kind of almost frontier town place, kind of America and the Caribbean. But insurance rates there, especially since the hurricane seasons that preceded and included Hurricane Katrina, have really gone through the roof. The middle class is finding it harder and harder to find insurance. Police officers are finding it hard to live there. Teachers are finding it hard to live there. And so more and more, let's say the middle class is being displaced by people who can afford to buy a home there, can afford to insure it there, and perhaps can afford to rebuild if there ever is a disaster that strikes.
And again, during Katrina, we saw very clearly the value of high ground. So I wonder, at what point do you think we'll start seeing coastal land as just too vulnerable to inhabit?
I would guess that just judging by the way we've acted in the last 50 or 60 years, it's going to be a while before we reach that point. We seem to be able to offset the risks that we think. I mean, I'm talking for you, to you from the Bay Area, where we're still waiting for the next hurricane or for the next earthquake.
Earthquake, yeah. It's been a while.
There's an earthquake or a hurricane, we seem to be able to make those decisions later. The interesting thing about the insurance is it makes us make the decision now. The insurance companies put a price on the risk and therefore make people make that decision right away.
Stefan Faris, my guest for another few minutes here on WNYC, author of the new book Forecast, The Consequences of Climate Change from the Amazon to the Arctic, from Darfur to Napa Valley. And we've been talking mostly about the negative things. Here's an interesting item from your book. To the shipping industry, the melting ice in the Arctic is seen not as a threat, but as an opportunity for an intercontinental shortcut, capitalizing on the melting ice caps. It might seem particularly grim to somebody who's concerned about the large effects of global warming, but what's the opportunity there?
Well, the Arctic ice, as you probably know, is melting at a rate actually much faster than anybody anticipated. Just in the next decade or two, it could be totally gone, at least in the summertime. And that makes it much easier for ships to go through there. If you have ice that has been building up for decades, that ice is really strong and really hard and really difficult to engineer a ship that can cut through it. If you have ice that basically disappears in the summer and freezes in the winter, that's much easier to engineer a ship that can go through it. And so therefore, we have a prospect of essentially a shortcut. Most dramatic might be, you could say, going from, say, Germany to Japan, instead of having to go down the European coast, through the Mediterranean, through the Suez Canal, or across the Pacific, through the Panama Canal, or if you're a big ship that's too big to go through the Panama Canal all the way down around Argentina, you can now just kind of go over the top of the world, and you're cutting off huge chunks of your trip.
And there are natural resources beneath the ice, like metals and oil, which people have their eyes on, right?
Absolutely. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that the Arctic may be one of the last places that has huge amounts of undiscovered oil. It's kicked off, I think, somewhat of a geopolitical race between the northern countries, which include us, includes Canada, includes Denmark, includes Norway, and includes Russia. So you have this strange situation where you have, countries that we don't tend to think of as being terribly bellicose, like Denmark and Canada, all of a sudden beating their chests over little pieces of rock. And of course, they don't really care about the rock. What they care is about the ocean around it and their claim for the minerals that might be inside that.
So the global warming exposes more oil, which we can burn and create more global warming.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a huge link between all sorts of interesting ways between global warming and oil. In the north, it exposes more oil. But let's say in the Gulf of Mexico, Hurricane Katrina did huge damage to oil rigs, and so therefore it makes it more difficult. In Alaska, the melting permafrost threatens the pipelines that lead down towards the U.S., and so therefore you may have a situation where the oil becomes harder to extract. But there is global warming basically is affecting everything and every aspect of our lives to some extent, and the oil industry is included in there.
You also fear that the melting of the Himalayan glaciers may potentially exacerbate an already volatile situation in the Kashmir region. Now, we don't think about South Asia as necessarily affected by the melting of the Arctic or the melting of ice caps in the mountains. What's the relationship?
Sure. I mean, there you have the glaciers in the mountains are an important source of agricultural water, and they essentially act as natural storage areas. You have the snow falling in the winter, it freezes, it stays there, and then it melts in the spring and summer and runs off during the agricultural season. There's quite an expectation those Himalayan glaciers will be disappearing. And what you're going to have then, and what's already starting to happen from what I understand, is that you have the snow falling, maybe not even sticking, maybe just turning to rain and flushing away in the wintertime when it's not really useful to anybody. So maybe it floods you in the wintertime, but when you need it for crops, it's not there anymore. And that becomes especially critical in the situation there with Pakistan and India, because Pakistan depends on the water that goes through Kashmir for about 80 or 90% of its agricultural water. That means that region, that area, which has in that conflict, which has predominantly been one of identity and whether they're Muslims or part of a greater secular India, may become increasingly about water.
You said before you go, you said you're in the Bay Area of San Francisco, right?
That's right.
So you get one of the little benefits of global warming out there, it looks like, because you write about how global warming is producing stronger and better vintages of Napa Valley wine.
That's right. Well, it has so far, anyhow. The global warming that we've experienced so far, according to one guy who studies this stuff, it has actually made wine just about as good as it can possibly be. He does say that as it continues to warm, that's expected to drop off, and the best wine may no longer be from Napa Valley, but maybe further up in Oregon.
Huh. Not a trade-off that you're willing to make, though, even if the wine stays good for a long time, right?
That's right. I actually live in Rome most of the time, and the same scientist has said that the best place to grow Chianti, which is a Tuscan wine, by 2050 might be in Germany. And the best place to grow Champagne, which is a French region of France, might be in southern England.
So winners and losers. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's no moral gain or loss in the wine country moving from California to Oregon or Italy to Germany, right?
On some level, yes. On another level, no. We have a long-standing and expensive set of infrastructure in these areas. We have marketing that's been developed around these regions. We have land use and ownership that's been developed. So if we were in a world where nobody owned anything or you didn't have to worry about untangling all these things, but, you know, if the wine is good now in Chianti and it has to move to Germany, well, what's there where those crops are? What are we going to be displacing? And what's going to be the cost of displacing that? We're more or less, for just about all of human civilization, we haven't seen much of a shift in average temperature of much more than, say, about half a degree centigrade or maybe 0.6 degrees centigrade, which is about a little bit less than a degree Fahrenheit. We're talking at the very minimum, even if the most ambitious efforts to combat global warming go into effect, of a shift of around 2 degrees centigrade. And so we're going to a world that we've never seen before as a civilization. As a race, we may have seen it, but as a civilization, we've never seen it. As a race, we haven't seen it, but...
Stefan Faris's new book is Forecast, The Consequences of Climate Change, from the Amazon to the Arctic, from Darfur to Napa Valley. Watch out for those mosquitoes, Stefan.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up in a minute, we'll follow up on that with the question, what makes a green dry cleaner?